This is Jason Stewart with the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, conducting an oral history interview with Mr. John DeGroot. Today is May 27, 2010. I'm in Lubbock, Texas in the Special Collections Library on the campus of Texas Tech, and Mr. DeGroot is joining me by phone from Illinois. Is that correct, sir?
Yes, it is.
All right. Okay, why don't we begin with a little bit of biographical information. First of all, when and where were you born?
I was born in Chicago, Illinois, in April 15th, 1950.
All right. Okay, could you tell me a little bit about your parents? What were their names and what did they do for a living?
Oh, that's a great question. My mother and my father were divorced when I was quite young.
Okay.
And my mother was a secretary. She was a pretty hardworking secretary, and I lived with her and my grandmother for most of my younger life. And my father, he was a heat treater by trade, and
okay.
He lived on the west side of Chicago. And then at the end of his life, and just around the time I went in the Army, just before that, he bought a tavern.
Okay. All right. So did you grow up there in Chicago?
Yes, I did.
Okay. Could you talk a little bit about what that was like for you, just life in Chicago as a kid?
Well, it was different times, to say the least. You could, even as an 8 or 9 year old, you could take public transportation anywhere, and we didn't have a car. My mother didn't have a car, so I took public transportation to get wherever I wanted in the city.
Mm-hmm.
Knew it quite well. I underachieved in school quite a bit, which I changed my ways later after Vietnam, and went to grammar school and moved here and there, and then wound up in high school, and probably the only thing I did well in was print shop, and
mm-hmm.
I worked on a co-op educational program where I would work half a day and go to school half a day, where you weren't expected to go to college.
Okay.
And, you know, just grew up going to Cubs games and things like that. Got in a little bit of a trouble when I was a kid. You know, it was a rough city, so you'd hang with a rough
mm-hmm.
crowd. So I wouldn't say I was a juvenile delinquent, but it was rough. You were always getting into fights and things like that. So
mm-hmm.
I grew up sort of in a tough little way, I guess.
Right.
Then I started working at this print shop, Paul's Printing, and I had an inkling some of my friends wanted to go into the military, and I wound up volunteering for the draft so my parents wouldn't know.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, before we get into actually joining the Army and getting into basic training and all of that, I'm going to ask you a few more questions about early life. Did you have any interest in the military as a kid growing up, or had you had any relatives that had served?
No, but I had some neighbors, and actually I knew a lot of World War II
mm-hmm.
guys. A lot of my friends had, you know, their fathers had served in World War II, and I was fascinated with history my whole young life.
Okay.
Especially the Civil War and things like that. So I was always had a fascination with war and the military, and especially, you know, historic facts, American historic facts, even when I was young.
All right. Okay. Not to deviate too much from the regular questions, but you said you went to a lot of Cubs games as a kid. What was that like for you?
That was interesting because, you know, I'd be like about 9 years old, and my grandmother would give me $2. I was off of the Addison bus line, and for $2 you could go to the Cubs game, car fare, have a hot dog and a pop, and there was only about 4,000 or 5,000 people at the game, so you could even sneak into the box seats, and that's all you needed was a couple of dollars, and that was everything your whole day.
Right.
So it was pretty neat. So I would go down there and just watch the Cubs all by myself.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, nowadays, you know, you'd be pretty fearful of your kid going anywhere at that age, you know, let alone taking a bus.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. All right. Okay. Well, did you, growing up, did you pay much attention to what was going on in the Cold War, U.S. foreign policy, that type of thing?
Yeah, well, I guess we would be having drills all the time for atomic bomb attacks and things like that, and I think it was in the back of everybody's mind, and I don't vividly remember, but I definitely can remember the you know, the Cuban Missile Crisis. It seems like even though I couldn't comprehend what was going on, it was it got your attention.
Right.
And yeah, I think we were all aware of, especially when the Sputnik went up. I remember that. And you know, we weren't yet really in the space program, and then you know, John Glenn doing his orbits and things like that. So I sure do remember things like that that were would be probably related to the Cold War.
All right. How about other things like, say, the Kennedy assassination?
Oh yeah. Well, everybody, I think I was 13 then, and everybody remembers where they were at when it happened. I was in Locke Grammar School, and I remember it coming on, and everybody was glued to their black and white TV sets, you know, watching the procession and all the, you know, everything that had to do. It was just, you were mesmerized by it, the whole country. It was really pretty incredible. It's hard even as a 13-year-old not to know what you were doing at that time.
Right, right. Yes, sir. All right. When did you graduate from high school? What year was that again?
1968.
Okay. All right. Well, prior to that, had you paid much attention to what was going on in Vietnam?
Yes and no. I remember in high school we had probably somebody that had dropped out of high school, had served in the Marines, and actually had come back to Steinmetz High School where I went.
Okay.
And he had been to Vietnam already.
Right.
And it was amazing that he was coming back to finish up his education.
Mm-hmm.
So that hit you home, and then especially in my senior year, I had one friend, Larry Davis, and he had joined Marines, and another friend of mine. They had both dropped out of high school. A lot of my friends had dropped out of high school.
Mm-hmm.
And I had two friends that were in the military.
Okay.
So you had an idea what was going on, and they both went to Vietnam. One got shot up pretty bad, and another one was killed.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Those that came back, did you talk to them very much about their experiences?
No, not really.
Mm-hmm.
Not really, to tell you the truth, because it was, you know, being just in senior year of high school, I just had the one guy that was in high school that he didn't really want to talk about anything. I just knew he was a Marine and he had come back and he had done in Vietnam, and I don't think he wanted to talk about it at all.
Right.
My other friends went to Vietnam after I had gone in the Army, but they were in the service well before me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. And you said you joined. Could you talk about a little bit more about that process of actually joining?
Yeah. Well, what happened is I was working. I graduated in June.
Mm-hmm.
I was working a third shift at this print shop, which I had sort of been doing an apprenticeship at. And the third shift was horrible as it was. And I was just a kid that was just wandering around. I really didn't know what to do with myself. And I had an inclination. I just went down to the draft board. I didn't want to tell my parents. I didn't want to join outright.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew you could volunteer for the draft and push your name up. They didn't have the number system then.
Okay.
And I went down to the draft board, and I signed up for the draft. They would call it signing up for the draft.
Mm-hmm.
And I probably, in September, I got a greetings letter. So
okay.
My mother was just shocked. She says, "You're just out of high school. I can't believe they're doing this so fast." And my father was a little oblivious to it. And I never told him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I just got drafted. And then I think October was the induction date.
Okay.
October 21st.
Okay. All right. And what was it really that made you decide to go ahead and do that?
In all honesty, I can't tell you why I did that.
All right.
I really don't know. I just you know, you're just a kid and just you feel like doing something.
Mm-hmm.
I guess. I don't know.
Right. Okay.
I volunteered for everything my whole life, and I still don't know why.
Sure. All right. Okay. So you said induction date was October 21st. Where did that take place?
That took place at Van Buren Street. They used to have the induction center down on Van Buren Street in downtown Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And my father picked me up, I think it must have been 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. And my father drove from his house on the west side, came and got me, and left me off there with, and he says, let me know what time you want me to pick you up tonight.
Right.
I think for some reason, I don't know, I'll never forget that. For some reason, he just didn't think I was going.
Uh-huh. Right. So I assume once you were inducted at that point, they went ahead and sent you to basic then?
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Fort Campbell, Kentucky. That night, we got on an airplane out of O'Hare.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a whole day affair, and then we got into Fort Campbell quite late.
Okay. All right. What was the experience like of arriving at Fort Campbell and getting off of that bus? Were you greeted by the drill instructors immediately?
Oh, my God, yeah. That was like, I remember you had the bare necessities, and we were so tired when we got in there. I think we fell asleep, and we must have got an hour's sleep, and then they woke us up, and that's when I met Drill Sergeant Johnson, my drill instructor, and they shaved our heads and just gave us a cap, and our heads were immediately cold, and I'll tell you later about Drill Sergeant Johnson, what a character.
Okay. All right. Well, I guess if you could talk a little bit about what basic was like for you and a typical day at basic training.
Well, it was incredible. I think we would, they would just push you to the limit. I think we would probably get up about 3 o'clock in the morning, it would seem, and go to bed at around 10 after we would polish things and everything else. And every day was just rigorous physical training.
Mm-hmm.
You know, running, we'd start running, and then I think you had about 5 minutes to have a shower. You had about 2 minutes to eat your lunch or dinner or breakfast after that, and then you were in formation. And it was starting to get a little bit chilly. This was October.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think you just go through the same things all the time, bayonet drill and then the rifle range, and you do one thing after another. And I just remember it started getting cold. But it was a southern cold, which I wasn't used to, a damp cold, you know,
mm-hmm.
unlike the north where it's cold, but it doesn't go right through you.
Right.
And I remember we'd go out to the rifle range, and just absolutely, it was freezing. Absolutely, I would be frozen to death and just chilled to the bone. And it was just constant work. We never had a second to ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I got sick for a while, and they almost recycled me. I had, I think, like the beginning of pneumonia, and they took me into the hospital. I was as sick as a dog, and I just begged the doctors to let me out so I didn't get recycled. I did not want to go through basic training again. It was
right.
Just, I couldn't even imagine going through it again. It was just torturous every day.
Mm-hmm. All right. You mentioned, you talked about going out to the rifle range and weapons training. Were you training on M14s? Or
yes. Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, it was. And we didn't have the M16s yet, at least at that basic training at Fort Campbell. We had M14s, and I qualified as expert on the M14.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And they really did teach how to shoot pretty well, and I got pretty adept at the M14.
Right. When did you receive your introduction to the M16 at advanced?
AIT.
Okay.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
All right.
That's when we got into the M16.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that's when I was delayed with my AIT too, but I guess we'll get to basic training first.
Okay. All right. Well, would you mind go ahead and talk a little bit about your drill instructor? Your
Drill Sergeant Johnson still has a impression on me to this day that I can't believe. He was as black as coal, just back from Vietnam, about 6'3",
mm-hmm.
and he had a torso. He was just absolutely in incredible shape.
Mm-hmm.
His uniform, he was so stracked, so starched, and he was an E6.
Mm-hmm.
And he was with the 25th Infantry Division, had a CIB coming back from Vietnam. And I remember Drill Sergeant Johnson early in our days, must have been the first couple of weeks. He had the whole platoon in the Bay Area, and he had caught two of our platoon mates eating candy.
Mm-hmm.
And in front of the entire platoon, Drill Sergeant Johnson took one by the scruff, another by the other hand, picked them up off their feet, and beat them with each other.
Wow.
And threw them down on the ground right in front of us.
Wow.
And I'm an 18-year-old kid, and my jaw just, it's one of my favorites, right? My jaw just hung down, and I just said, I am so happy Drill Sergeant Johnson's on our side.
Right.
And it's the truth. But he was a fair guy, and he was just, he liked me for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just a great drill sergeant. I mean, he was getting ready for combat, and he was just, I'd like to shake his hand today. He just had such an impression on me.
Mm-hmm.
Just what a good troop he was.
Mm-hmm.
So, oh, and we had another drill corporal there that, he was with the 18th, I remember all these units, but he was from Vietnam, and he was with the 18th MP Brigade.
Okay.
But he must have been one of the grunts, because he had a CIB as well.
Right.
And he was a drill corporal, and he used to shave in the morning with a combat knife.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, true.
Right.
It's hard to believe nowadays, but I remember, I don't remember his name,
mm-hmm.
but I remember he was with the, he had the 18th MP Brigade combat patch, and I've looked at their history since, and they did have some infantry attached to him.
Okay.
So he must have been an infantryman attached to that brigade.
Right.
And then Drill Sergeant Johnson was with the 25th Infantry Division. I remember that, and had a CIB as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did either of them make many references to Vietnam in the training?
I think they did in some ways. I think everybody just said, well, you're all going to Vietnam, and boy, you better just, you know, get your head out of your ass and stuff like that. Yeah, they were,
right.
They were, you know, they made no bones about it. They were getting you ready for war.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. All right. Well, outside of picking up people and beating them with each other, how else would they enforce discipline?
They didn't really have to. You just were so scared of them, you weren't going to do nothing at that point.
Right.
I think they made their point. There was no discipline. If they told you to jump, you'd say, how high? You know, and they'd take you out running every morning. They did have some instances, though. I remember one guy, they didn't like how he shaved one morning,
mm-hmm.
and they had him get in front of a whole, I think it might have been a whole company, and they had him take his razor and dip it in the buck can and shave with that in front of a whole company. And I think that, and they broke some people down. They'd have them just crying in front of people, the whole particular
mm-hmm.
company, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, they were just ruthless.
Right.
That's how they would enforce discipline. You're just scared to do anything wrong. You know?
Right.
Yeah?
All right. Well, overall, did you find the training you went through at basic pretty sufficient as far as an introduction to the military?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We could really march, and I could shoot, and I was full of piss and vinegar. I was in as good a shape as you can be, you know, and
because
mm-hmm. all you did was, you couldn't even walk in the company area. You had to run anywhere you went.
Mm-hmm.
We never got to the PX or anything like that.
Right.
It was just constant work.
Mm-hmm.
You were just a scumbucket. You were going to work.
Right. So then you felt overall that you were adjusting to the military lifestyle pretty well?
Yeah. I was surviving, put it that way.
Okay.
That's a better way of putting it. I'd say I was surviving.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, you really didn't have time to even think.
Right, right. All right. Well, any other memorable moments or funny moments, anything like that, that sticks out in your mind from basic?
From basic, I don't think we had. I can't remember things as I would say fun.
Okay.
I mean, it was just hard work and just a relief when we did finally graduate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then because it was December, they actually let us go home on a little leave in between that and our AIT.
Okay, right. All right. And where was AIT?
Fort Gordon, Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
Military police school. For some reason, they chose me to be a military policeman.
Mm-hmm. All right. What did you think about that assignment?
First of all, I was shocked they picked me to be a military policeman with all the troubles I had as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
I was usually on the other side of the law. I wasn't getting into trouble.
Right.
But it was interesting. It was, first of all, I I went to, they took me in a military police school, and they, you had to be a certain height at that time to be an enlisted man in this. So it was 5'10".
Okay.
So I remember they were measuring you and weighing you in and stuff and getting you ready, and they go, you just made the 5'10".
Hmm.
Well, I found out later that I've always been 5'8.5".
Mm.
But I had just made that. And then what happened, I also was too young to be a military policeman. You had to be 19 by the time of graduation.
Oh, okay.
And I was still 18, so they put me in a holding company.
Oh, really?
And a lot of these people, they would take and make them infantry after that and send you to different places. And they just kept me in this holding company for probably a good month or 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And I did mostly KP and just absolutely stupid details around there. It was pretty rotten,
like
actually.
Things like peeling potatoes and filling sandbags.
The whole thing. Well, the KP would be horrible because you would start at like 4 in the morning or something like that, and your night would not be over till 10 o'clock that night.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah. You would just, it was grueling. And these cooks would just boss you around and stuff. It was really, and it was hard work.
Mm-hmm.
So it was not fun at all.
Right. Right. So this was, you were in this holding company before actually beginning MP school?
Right. Because
okay.
They decided then they go, well, I couldn't be an MP because I was too young.
Right, right.
And then you were, who knows, they could send you, a lot of people, they would send them to infantry school then and stuff like that. They just kept me into this holding company for about a month, and then they said, you're going back to military police school.
Okay.
And they started me in military police school.
Oh, right. Okay. What was that experience like for you?
That was interesting. It was a lot of bookwork and schoolwork at that time. I think I even sent my stuff down to Texas Tech. I had my original school books and
okay.
notebook. And it was everything you had to learn to be a policeman. They didn't teach us so many combat tactics, even though they would take you out and, with M60 one day and the grenade launchers and things of that nature, you know, M79. They were
right.
really teaching you mostly police work, which the Army changed later because they found out that too many MPs were getting killed because they didn't have the combat training. But back then it was all police work. So it was everything about how to use a radio to law, military law, and how to apprehend somebody, judo classes, how to use your nightstick. 45, they were very big in training because that was a military police basic weapon.
Mm-hmm.
M16, I think they qualified us on the M16 as well. And I didn't shoot as well with the M16
okay.
as I did with the M14. And the 45, I just got by with the marksman badge. But it was a big emphasis on police work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how to write up tickets and all the forms and things like that. And that was 8 weeks long.
Right. Okay. All right. How about your instructors there? What were your impressions of those guys?
They were okay. They were. It was a. You know, they weren't as tough on you as they were in basic training. There was no. There's only one drill sergeant, Johnson. They were very thorough, and they treated you a little bit better. But also the spin and shine in the military police corps. We were actually brassoing our garbage cans and shining the bottoms of our boots and stuff. It was insane.
Right.
It was all spit shine. You know, military policemen, it was all spit shine, and it was a branch of the Army unto itself.
Mm-hmm.
So you would learn all about the colors of the military police being green and gold and things like that. And there was a lot of pride in being a policeman. A lot of, and most of the military policemen, I would say 90% were RA or regular Army. They had signed up to be military policemen because they wanted to get into law enforcement or something like that later on.
Okay.
So most were had signed up to get their choice of branch of the Army.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I know you talked about them not really focusing too much on combat, but on police work instead. But how about as far as was it focused on generally being an MP, or was there some emphasis on being an MP in Vietnam?
There was not that much emphasis put on being a military policeman in Vietnam.
Okay.
And I think they were very remiss in that, to tell you the truth. And I think after lessons learned, they did change the whole, well, I went in Army Reserve years later, and they had changed their whole way they looked at military policemen after that, after the Vietnam era.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Because you would probably have some interaction, I'm sure, with the Vietnamese, did they teach you anything like Vietnamese culture or language, anything
no.
like that? Okay.
No.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, you still could get, a lot of the military policemen were still going over to Germany yet.
Right.
They used them all to guard all the nuke sites and stuff, too, which mm-hmm. was a waste of a military policeman.
Mm-hmm.
They put them in a tower. That was for 12-hour shifts, watching nukes, doing nothing else.
Right.
So it was such a waste of resources when you think of it. But mm-hmm. they were basically training you to be a policeman in the Army anywhere.
Okay. All right. So at that point, you still weren't sure if you would be going to Vietnam or not?
No,
right?
I was not.
Okay. All right. Well, overall, as far as the MP school training is concerned, how would you rate it as far as getting you ready for what you would be doing?
It was pretty good, but you really need a lot of OJT after that,
uh-huh.
especially interacting with people, and because you know you're always a bad guy in
mm-hmm.
people's eyes, and you know getting out there, they would have you doing a traffic direction and stuff like that. But until you really got into it, I think you really had to have a lot of training on site after you got out of this school.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, any memorable moments or humorous moments, anything like that from AIT?
Well, there was, we had one guy that actually had a infantry MOS,
mm-hmm.
but he had signed up for the military police, and he finally got into military police school after going through that, and he could impersonate John Wayne to a T.
Really?
Yeah, and he had red hair, a very likable guy. I can't remember his name, but, you know, it's like if you would have a question in class or something, you know, it'd be 100 of us in a class, he'd raise his hand and he'd just speak to him like John Wayne. And he would just crack him up all the time. And, you know, he was just a crack. And then at this time, they too did let us go to the PX.
Mm-hmm.
And they had where we could drink 3-2 beer also.
Okay.
I remember that. So we did have times where we could get out and actually be human beings. And one of the people I worked at the print shop with, all of a sudden I'm in PX number 9. I remember PX number 9.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, there's somebody I used to work with walks right by me, Sam Bianchi, and he was a military policeman down there.
Huh. Okay.
So it's a small world.
Right.
And it was okay. You know, I was ready for anything. And I think they would always use me, like, as the Chicago kid. Like, if they needed something swiped from some place to get, I'd always be the one that swiped something.
Right.
So.
All right. Well, let's see. Now, at that point, did you receive the assignment to Vietnam?
No. I actually received assignment to 63rd Military Police Platoon in Bayonne, New Jersey.
Okay.
And that was a military ocean terminal. And things were going back and forth, and we would do our police duties there as well as port security.
Okay.
And I was there until almost I graduated military police school the 19th of April.
Okay.
4 days after my 19th birthday. And then we took a train up through Washington, D.C., and to Bayonne, New Jersey, which is basically New York City. I looked out my little barracks window, and I would see the Statue of Liberty.
Okay.
And
wow.
We had a little platoon there, the 63rd Military Police Platoon, MOPI,
mm-hmm.
Military Ocean Terminal, Bayonne. And we would do gate guard duty. We would watch the POVs coming in. We do warehouse security because things were coming and going all the time,
mm-hmm.
and it was we do the strangest duty. We'd have 3 days on days, 3 days on the second shift, 3 days on the third shift, and 3 days off.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really hard to get used to a shift like that.
Sure.
Pretty ridiculous.
Right.
And I still have one of my friends. He lives out here in, near me, and we're still good friends, and he was stationed there with me as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then every month or so, we'd find a body floating in the harbor there, and we'd have to retrieve it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there's always floaters, we call them. And
wow.
That was our job to sort of pick them out of there and get them in an ambulance in there. And it was okay duty.
Mm-hmm. All right. When you would have your days off, did you get a chance to go into the city?
Yeah, all the time, but making $89 a month, your money did not go far. And I actually had a cousin that lived there, and we'd go into the city all the time, and it was interesting. New York City. I'm from Chicago, but I felt like the farm boy from Chicago. Yeah, New York's always made an impression on me after that.
Right, right. All right. Well, how long were you in this position?
I was there. Until October. I volunteered for Vietnam duty.
Oh, okay.
After that, like I said, I always had it. Inkling to volunteer for things. I volunteered for Vietnam shortly. I still got the paperwork somewhere. Shortly after a friend of mine was killed, one of my high school friends I mentioned was killed
mm-hmm.
in Vietnam.
Right.
And I decided, well, I need to do something mm-hmm. more, and I volunteered for Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Do you think you probably would have eventually been sent there anyway?
No, not really. My one buddy wasn't. In fact, I asked him, you want to go with me, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, what, are you nuts? And I tried to go into airborne school, too, at that time, and he wouldn't let me go airborne after that, which is a shame. I really, one of my big regrets is that I never went airborne.
Mm. All right. Well, once you volunteered, how long did it take at that point before you were actually assigned to Vietnam?
Well, it took a while because they... first of all, they couldn't block the paperwork. It was one thing if you did that, even though your unit didn't want to lose you and stuff and would love to block it,
mm-hmm.
they couldn't block it. So I'm going to say I went to RVN training at Fort Dix.
Okay.
Probably August, I'm going to say.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like a 1 or 2 week course.
All
and
right.
then I got another leave in October, and I think I went out over in October to Vietnam.
Okay. All right. What was the curriculum there at the RVN training?
Showing you what booby traps were about, and I think also firing an M16 again, qualifying again.
Mm-hmm.
I remember booby traps, things like that, and just... you know, getting you used to, you're going over there and just getting you sort of ready.
Mm-hmm. Any language or cultural training there?
There might have been a booklet they had put up, but no, they didn't
have okay.
cultural training.
All right.
Somewhere along the line, they did tell us, you know, don't pat them on the head and stuff, but I think that was once we got there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So did you have a little bit of a leave there before actually going over to Vietnam?
Yeah, I did. I came back home.
Mm-hmm. All right. How long was that, 30 days? Or?
No, I think it was 2 weeks.
Okay.
I had already taken some time off because my friend's parents had requested me for his funeral.
Mm-hmm.
So I had come home for that, too. That was in June. He was only in Vietnam, I think, 12 days before he got killed.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Right. Well, what was your family's reaction to you being to you going to Vietnam?
I think they were guarded about it. I don't think they said too much. I didn't tell them I volunteered, naturally.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But it's just, well, that's the way it's going to be. You know, what we'll be, you'll be okay. And I just reassured them. I said, well, I'm military. Nothing will happen to me. You know, I just kept telling them, I got an easy job, things of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
So.
All right.
You know, that's what I was trying to tell them. Oh, in fact, I think, I've got my volunteer form here right in front of me.
Oh, okay.
Request for overseas assignment. and what's the due date of a date? The date was 12th of June, 1969.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. All right. Well, could you talk a little bit, I guess, about the actual trip over and what that was like? Did you fly civilian airlines?
Yeah, we flew Tiger Airlines.
Okay.
And I remember a layover in Hawaii. They gave it, first of all, it was amazing. I flew out of Chicago, I think, on a Sunday night. And I went to Oakland Military Ocean Terminal. And I didn't bring much stuff with me because I knew they were just going to take it and give me new stuff anyway.
Well,
I was there. I went through the terminal so quickly, I couldn't believe it. They gave me uniforms, everything else. And I'm going to say I got there maybe at 10 o'clock at night. I'll bet you 4 o'clock in the morning I was on a plane.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. As far as the plane ride over is concerned, what was the mood like on there? Were people talking about what to expect, or was it pretty quiet?
It was pretty quiet. I was next to some, I think I was next to some Signal Corps officer, and I don't think we were, I think we were all a little apprehensive, but I think it was really quiet, if I remember right. It's got a lot. And we did have one more layover. We went had a layover in Hawaii really quick. That was an hour or so.
Mm-hmm.
We walked around the airport. And then we had, they opened the doors. Then we landed probably at Clark in the Philippines, and they opened up the door, and that was my first taste of the tropics. And it was, it was like, oh, my God.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So I remember that distinctly.
Mm-hmm.
Besides that, it was just a real long, tiresome trip.
Sure. Mm-hmm. How long were you there at Clark before moving on to...
An hour or two.
Oh, just an hour or two.
Yeah,
okay.
Just, I think, refuel, and that was it. It wasn't long. I don't even know if we got much off of the plane. I don't even know if we got off the plane at all.
Mm-hmm. All right. Where did you come into country?
Long Bend,
okay.
Yeah, because I remember seeing a lot of 82nd airborne people around there, and I remember going on the on the bus, and they had the screens on the bus, you know, to keep grenades out and stuff on there, and you could smell the rice paddies and
mm-hmm.
the heat and that, so it was making an impression already.
Mm-hmm. Right. All right. Well, what was in processing like?
I just remember, I think they had a mess with you, you know, and fill some sandbags or something, and you're sweating, and that was quick, too. I would think that I might have even been on a plane. I don't even know if I spent the night.
Mm-hmm.
I can't quite remember because, you know, I've had so many of these little adventures like this in my life. I just remember I was quickly sent up north.
Okay. All right. So at that point, you received your assignment to the...
In AmeriCal, yes.
Okay. All right. Okay. And was it the 23rd MP Company?
Right.
Okay. All right. Did you receive any further training in country?
Right. They had the combat school at Chulai, which was the division headquarters.
Okay.
And I think it was a week or 2 weeks. I'm not sure.
All right.
But that was more, they were showing you what sappers could do. That made an impression on how they could contort bodies. They had a couple of chuhoys,
mm-hmm.
and they would show you how they could contort themselves going through barbed wire and, diffuse flares and things like that. And you go, whoa. And again, to the rifle range, they didn't have you zero in your weapon, so which I found rather, now after years that I spent in the military, that they didn't have you zero in your weapons. Here's your weapon and just go to range and fire, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But that, and the range that they took us to was at LZ Bayonet, which is where I would be assigned with the 198th Light Infantry.
Okay. All right. What was the location of LZ Bayonet? Was it close to Chulai?
Very close to Chulai. It was at the southeast tip of Chulai. It almost bordered on Chulai.
Okay.
But it was on the other side of QL1, Highway 1.
Okay.
And it really was like, I would say, probably guarded the southwest approach to Chulai.
Okay. All right. Could you talk a little bit about a little? Could you give a little description of the base itself there?
Well, it was just a dust bowl mud hole. It was pretty big when I look at pictures of it now. It was actually bigger than you would think, and I remember it vividly. Up the northern part of the LZ was the first of the six was there. At the southern part was the first of the 52nd infantry was there. I was towards the some hills that were on the west edge of LZ Bayonet, and this was the grace of living at LZ Bayonet. There was some real tall, like hill mountain, that was the westernmost part of LZ Bayonet, and this kept them from throwing in rockets on you.
Mm-hmm.
They could hit Chulai over us with rockets easily, and they would get quite a number of 122 rockets at them.
Right.
But they couldn't really get the trajectory from the rocket pocket, which was just west of us, to get rockets into LZ Bayonet because of this hill mountain, which we had OPs up there and things of that nature.
Okay.
So we would get mortars every so often. But it would come when you didn't expect it. And it was a big enough base. Unless they had a major attack, which one night they did, and they actually overran that line up there.
Oh, wow.
Mortars were sporadic. You know, you just, one night they drop a few in, and, you
mm-hmm.
know, other nights they wouldn't, you know, just when you didn't expect it.
Right. All right. How about things like your quarters and things there at LZ Bayonet?
They were, some places they would have bunkers, but mm-hmm. because we didn't have the rocket problem, they had hooches with sandbags that went halfway up them.
Okay.
And also 50-gallon drums filled with sand all around there.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had bunkers naturally all over the place. But we didn't have to have bunker underground to live like that because there wasn't that much of a rocket problem.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there was rats running all over the place and things like that. But it kept the rain off of you. And,
right.
You know, I was fortunate that, you know, I'd be out there all day on patrol and stuff. But, you know, most of the times I had a place to come back at night that I could take off all my wet stuff, which is a lot better than poor infantry did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. All right. Well, could you talk a little bit about, I guess, your first impressions of the unit, of the 23rd MP Company? And you don't have to go into specific names if you don't want to, but
right.
If you could talk a little bit about some of the personalities you ran into as well.
Well, it was what was funny about the 23rd Military Police Company is, and this still sticks to today to our reunions, is you had the mother company that was up at Chulai.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had platoons that were assigned to each of the three infantry brigades.
Okay.
In my case, I was the 3rd platoon, which was attached to the 198th infantry, and then we had the 1st platoon, which was with the 11th brigade, and then we had the 2nd platoon, which was with the 196th brigade at different LZs.
Okay.
Their headquarters. So there was a lot of animosity towards the mother company. And they didn't really care for us, and we didn't really care for them too much.
Right.
And it was sort of strange because you're all military policemen, but, you know, say at LZ Bayonet, we wouldn't... am I getting away from the whole question here?
No, you're not. Not at all.
We wouldn't shine our boots, and we'd wear, you know, helmets and stuff like that, where the MPs at Chulai had hooch maids, and they would have spit shine boots, and they would wear helmet liners. They were, like, more in the garrison.
Mm-hmm.
And we would be all the time on the road or with the infantry in that, and the MPs were basically doing police duty in Chulai. So it was a different culture within the company itself.
Uh-huh.
So we were closer to the infantrymen, and we got that way, and that was, like, the mindset of the 3rd platoon there at LZ Bayonet. And so we looked at ourselves as military policemen, but more like we felt more like attuned to the 198th Infantry Brigade.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. When you first came into country and joined the unit there, what, well, I guess, how were you received? Was there any of the new guy treatment, or were you welcomed pretty immediately?
I think we were welcomed pretty immediately because there was had been such a turnover of personnel. I think a whole bunch of us came in new at the same time or within a month.
Okay.
I think there was a huge turnover in my platoon. So we were basically, except for a couple of older guys like Ed Costello, who's acquainted somewhat with me now. I think he's angry at everybody now, but you know, I'll be not best to get. But Ed was really the guy to look for guidance, and he was a sergeant, and he really knew the ropes, and he really he took everybody out on patrol and taught you pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
So you needed to get that roughness. You had to know where to go and how not to get into trouble because, you know, it was dangerous on that road.
Mm-hmm.
So it was good that we had the older guys that were there were very, treated us pretty good, the couple that were left.
Mm-hmm.
And they really did show us the ropes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, could you talk a little bit about, I guess, just some of the things that they taught you to do and to look out for?
Well, basically, not to go off to this road. You know, you learn this. I think we had about 90 kilometers that we would patrol of QL1. And, you know, don't go down here because, you know, it's really bad. You could get killed down here because there's Viet Cong down here. You found out where all the whorehouses were and stuff, where guys would be held up, you know, and where you'd have to rouse people out and about, you know, off limits and just speed limits and things like that for accidents. We had a lot of accidents. So many different things could happen on that road. It was incredible. And it was just you and another MP.
Mm-hmm.
And you could be 30 kilometers away from the nearest patrol.
Mm.
All you had was this radio that sometimes worked.
Right.
And, you're a kid. So it was sort of preparing you for stuff like that, you know, and we would do everything from give out traffic citations to mop up scenes to, you know, mine explosions, you know. We didn't do convoy duty too much, though, which the other platoons did more of.
Okay.
Our platoon didn't do too much convoy duty, but we would do everything else that you could imagine. Anything that could happen, you know, and you get some rifle fire once in a while. You get some wayward Viet Cong that take a couple pot shots at you, and you know, if he was a sniper, he would hit you, but, you know, and it'd be stuff like that. Every day was a new adventure.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, before we get more into your actual duties, a few more questions about the unit at this time. Because at this point in the war, how was morale at that point among the guys in the unit?
That's a great question. It was starting to get low because the war, it wasn't the height of war. Here it is, it's late 1969, 1970.
Mm-hmm.
And I think just like every place else, Jason, people were disillusioned.
Mm-hmm.
And they just wanted the thing to end. So I think you were seeing morale really take a nosedive at that time.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Well, how did people get along? Were there any problems among the guys in the unit? Any racial tension? Anything?
Yeah, there was a lot of racial tension all over the place.
Okay.
Yeah, it was really getting horrible about that time, especially in the rear areas. Even sometimes, I had black friends and white friends, and there was starting to be a separation between everybody at that point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was people you were almost being forced to take sides in a lot of ways. I sort of tried to avoid that, but, there was going to be a real lot of racial tension.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. How about other things like alcohol problems or drug problems?
Oh, yeah. It was getting widespread, and it got worse as the year went on.
Mm-hmm. All right. Okay. Well, I guess if we could get into a little bit more specifics about your duties now. Patrolling Highway 1, what would be how far would you go?
Well, we had three patrols.
Okay.
And one patrol would go north, LZ Bay, and that being in the middle of the area. Mm-hmm. And one patrol would go north, one would go south, and then one would cover both.
Okay.
So you only had the three patrols, and the Chulai MPs would go as far as Anton, just outside the gate of Chulai. So basically, that was our entire area of responsibility.
Okay.
And you could be spread really thin. So you would just go up and down this road, and after a while, you knew every nook and cranny. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you'd go off to the side where you felt somewhat safe, but you'd have to watch out for mines and be just aware of your surroundings, you know, so you didn't get in trouble. And anything that would happen was your responsibility, be it an accident or, you know, we'd have to call in dust-offs and stuff, give traffic tickets, believe it or not. Some people were, there were so many accidents, people running over people on that. You didn't want to have that. And I had a, you just have to handle a lot of different situations constantly.
All right.
It was never a dull moment.
Did you guys have jurisdiction over the Americans and the Vietnamese?
No, but we carried a lot of times that we would have a QSAN, a QC, military policeman, mm-hmm. or we would have a White Mouse with us, or a National Police Field Force. We would have one of those in one of our patrols, mm-hmm. so we could have jurisdiction over just about everybody.
Okay. All right. What were your impressions of the QCs?
We had this one QC, he was just wonderful. What a nice, Howe was his name.
Okay.
And he was very strict and just a good kid, and he didn't speak English, but he, you could count on him. In fact, the national policeman we had too, another one, you could count on him too. You know, mm-hmm. So, you know, they wouldn't be afraid to draw their M16 and back you up. Mm-hmm. So we had a couple of good ones, and then we had a couple that were rather strange. Like Ben was another one. He was from the village of Nook Mau, which was by LZ Gator, which was south of Bayonet.
Okay.
And I remember him, he was kind of, I know he was very corrupt. But he was a National Police Field Force, which was different than the regular police.
Okay.
Paramilitary he was. And he had me in there, and I was talking to his brother-in-law, who was a, what did he call it? They had the black pajamas, but supposedly they were on our side.
Like the...
PF.
Yeah, PF's okay.
PF. And he was trying, he spoke perfect English, PF. And he wanted me to get him a plaque check, and then blah, 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 yeah, right, sure. Okay, and I guess a couple weeks later, he was killed. He was a Viet Cong.
Mm.
But I found that really strange, you know, especially with his command of English. This guy had an unusual command of English.
Right.
But and he was Ben's brother-in-law, so who knows where Ben was coming from.
Mm.
So,
mm-hmm.
You know, you just never knew.
Right, right. How, for those that, for the guys that couldn't speak English, how would you communicate with them?
Yeah, you'd find ways to communicate, and if you just tell you sign language.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you'd patrol with these guys all the time, and you'd know when something was up. But I know there was a couple of cases, not with me, but with another friend of mine, Mike Casey. He learned Vietnamese almost when he was over there, and he was very close to you, and they still communicate, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think you helped Casey in a couple of jams one time where you had his M16 out covering him, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that,
right.
They were pretty good guys,
right.
Most part.
All right. you mentioned... things like traffic accidents and things like that. How often would you see these accidents?
Oh, I'm going to say it could be once a week, a couple times a week, could be a couple times a day. And, you know, there was one case I remember by, not LZ Ross, but, LZ Dottie.
Mm-hmm.
There was a accident where a 5-ton truck, this was later in my career, a 5-ton truck, GI truck, had rammed into Arvin deuce and a half, and there was one body in the back. One of the boards from the side of the deuce and a half had snapped and gone right through the heart of this Arvin.
Mm-hmm.
And he was deader than a doornail. And the Arvins were naturally blaming the GI that drove this 5-ton. And, there's almost gunfights over this stuff. Mm-hmm. So I get there, and I didn't have a radio because the Chulai MPs, I think, had stolen it. And we got a situation here where it's got to be defused, otherwise somebody's going to get killed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's getting close to night, and I sent my partner back up north to try to get a wrecker so we could get this truck out of there before it got dark, because once it got dark, the road, you had to be in the LZ or you'd get killed, because Viet Cong just took over everything at night.
Right.
And he went up north. I'm trying to defuse the situation. The Arvins are just all pissed off. They want to just kill this GI. I find out that this GI was from Chicago and actually knew people I knew. And we finally got a tow truck in there, got this thing back. I defused the situation, and then the sergeant that was in charge of me was just reaming me out like I don't know what I was supposed to do. And basically, I was a squad leader, and then they demoted me from being a squad leader. I don't know. It was just, I thought I had done the right thing, and somehow I don't know what I should have done.
Right.
So, but I remember you'd come in situations like that.
Uh-huh.
And right. I still remember that poor Vietnamese soldier, you know, he's just a board right through his heart. Better than a doornail.
Right.
So, but you'd see things like that all the time. You'd see these little Lambrettis or whatever. They'd say, they'd hit a truck, and then you'd just see bodies all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Right.
People drove like crazy.
Right. All right. If there was an accident, say, between American forces and Vietnamese civilians, how would that be handled?
Well, we'd have, we'd try to get a national policeman in there.
Okay.
Well, if we didn't, but naturally the first thing in my mind was try to secure the area.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And just try to keep tempers down, okay, because everybody had a gun.
Right.
So it was, you'd have to play it by ear. Basically, you just want to protect the GIs first.
Right.
Okay. But you want to be fair, too. And you want to take care of the injured. If there's any injured, you try to get a dust off in there. You'd have to see if the area is secure,
mm-hmm.
or else try to take care of your injuries first and then just protect against this volatile situation, it could always explode.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, they were, at the end, they were taking hostages and everything else, the Arvins.
Right.
And we were having negotiations, and, people were pulling pins on hand grenades. And
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It'd get ugly.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know you talked about your impressions of the QCs, but how about of the Arvin and your interaction with them? What did you think of them?
I didn't think much of the Arvins.
Okay.
In most cases. I had a couple Arvin friends. There was a Sergeant Key that was an interpreter that worked with us. He was a good guy, but he was just happy not to be in the field and have a job at LZ Bayonet.
Mm-hmm.
I thought the Arvins, for the most part, were pretty worthless. They just wanted to live. You know, they were drafted, and it's like they were just caught in between everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of the GIs had a a distrustful taste for most of them. I've heard that the Rangers were pretty good and things like that, but I'd go out, and I flew door gunner, too, after a while, and I would go out in the field and
mm-hmm.
be picking up Arvins, and they were just so demoralized,
mm-hmm.
from so many years of war. It's like they're just placed out there. So I can see where most of them didn't have much feeling one way or another.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, you mentioned cases of tension between the Arvin and Americans during an accident, but as a result of an accident. But was that a normal thing that you'd see? Would there be a lot of tension between the Americans and the Arvin?
Yeah, in fact, there was one case when I think about it, and some of this was perpetrated by an American. Don't get me wrong, because I remember one time an Arvin was came into our PMO, which was our little police station at LZ Bayonet, and he's all wet, and he's just absolutely chatting around, and he is just absolutely pissed to the 10th degree. And I guess he was on his motorbike going by, like, some tracks from H Troop to 17th Cab, which was part of our home unit there, our armor that was out of with the 198, and somebody on the track got up and pissed on him, you know.
Oh, God.
Yeah, so you'd see something like that. So, yeah, we the Americans weren't the greatest to the Arvins either, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. All right. Well, how about other incidences on the road, such as you talked a little bit about the VC shooting at people. What about mines and things? Would they ever put mines on the road?
Yeah, they would put mines on the road, and I was always, it was paved, QL1 was paved, the route we had there, which was, you know, you go out of our AO bin and get unpaved.
Okay.
But it was paved, and I'll never forget, I'm going to say, February, March, I got a call, I was, that there was a mine explosion at this one coordinates on QL1. So we rushed there, and it was a grader from the 9th engineers from the Marines.
Okay.
So we have Marines mingled in our AO too. And this grader wasn't grading anything, but it was just going down the road.
Okay.
On this paved road, and it had actually, a mine went off right under this guy's seat on this grader.
Right.
And he was just driving from point A to point B. So somebody had command detonated this thing. They had dug this thing underneath the asphalt.
Oh, wow.
Okay?
Right.
And had put it right under a seat. And believe it or not, that seat was bent. This guy was fine. He didn't have a scratch on him.
Wow.
Yeah, that's true.
Right.
And so naturally, the first inclination I had, you know, is they had to dig underneath this road here.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to the edge of the road, this and that, but I knew enough you don't go off of that road because now that's a perfect plant. They're going to have another mine there for you to step on, you know.
Mm, right.
And we couldn't find no wires. We couldn't find nothing. But I didn't venture too far because I was almost assured that they probably had another booby trap there just waiting for somebody to go off the road because they were trying. Another case is LZ Artie Hill, which was just off the road. So a lot of these LZs, you could take a road off of QL1 and get to them, you could see them from the road.
Mm-hmm.
Another time they do a mine sweep in the morning, and a deuce and a half was going down this road from Artie Hill, and just after we, and it blew up, and we figured that they had packed C4 in glass and put it in there, so because there had just been a mine sweep. So, you know, they were always doing little tricks like that. You had to be worried about stuff like that.
Right. How about things like ambushes on the road? Was that ever?
We would get some fire every so often.
Okay.
A lot of times you'd have a bullet whiz over you. A couple of times, you know, there'd be like, you know, AK rounds hitting in front of you on the road. But I think it would be just, they weren't ambushing you.
Okay.
In that area, I mean, if we went a little bit north and south of our AO,
mm-hmm.
I think the probability would have been higher. Not that we were in a secure area, but I don't think that they were setting up their mission to do something like that. They were just waiting for nightfall, and they'd come and go as they want. But, yeah, we'd get some rifle fire in that, but not as much as you would think, because 2 men in an MPG, how easy would that be, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know.
Right.
We were always aware it could happen, but thankfully, it never did.
Mm-hmm. All right. With the sides of the road, would the brush and the bushes be cleared away?
Yes and no. In some areas, yes, in some areas, no.
Okay. All right. All right. And the patrols you guys would make only during the daytime?
Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Sometimes we would actually take a chance and go, even though Chulai was right across the street from us. We would go at night sometimes down QL1 into the front gate, which was about a mile, 2 miles, sometimes at night from LZ Bayonet, especially if we had something happen, we had rushed somebody to hospital or something. But we would actually get fire sometimes from, they used to call it the quarry. They were doing some quarry work, mm-hmm. and we'd actually take fire from there sometimes. So you had to be careful. At nighttime, it really was owned by the Viet Cong.
Okay. All right.
Or in most cases, and they were hardcore Viet Cong. I don't think we had a lot of secondary Viet Cong around there. I think they were very pretty well organized units in the I Corps area where I was at.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. How about other aspects of your duty? You mentioned basically rounding up guys in the whorehouses and things like
yeah.
that. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Oh, sure. You know, it was like, you know, we would, my platoon, unlike the Chulai MPs, we would take it easy on these guys. We didn't really care that much, you know. But if there was a case where you see like a convoy parked in front of a whorehouse, you know, with ammunition on it.
Right.
Well, you know, you go in there, come on, guys, you know. And the most times we would really turn a blind eye, you know, to all of this stuff. Because we knew how the grunts had it so bad as it is. And we really had most of us felt sort of bad for these guys. You know, they had a rough tour over there. And if we weren't going to go out of our way to make it hard on them.
All right.
But there was cases, though, where we had off-limits where, especially racial things, where guys wouldn't come in at, and there was a situation where I almost had to kill another GI, and we had to arrest them all, but it was far and few between.
Mm-hmm. Right. As in one bar belongs to one group and another bar belongs to another group, and you don't go into that bar?
No, there were no bars. Basically.
Okay.
No, we didn't. There was no place that we were afraid to go.
Okay.
Not like that, no.
Okay. All right.
That was our road. We, you know, we really felt we owned it, our little platoon, so.
Okay. All right. How about other things? Did you ever go off of the road into any villages or anything like
yes,
that?
Yes, yeah.
Okay.
A few times.
All right. What would you be doing when you would do that?
Sort of like snooping around, just because you got a feel for this whole area because you've been doing, you know, almost a year up and on. I'd be going up and down the road, and you knew everything. And sometimes you felt that this might be pretty safe, and we'd go maybe a click back on the side, you know, very cautiously. I mean, very cautiously. And one time we actually came upon somebody, they must have just got away, they were digging a pit for probably a 500-pound bomb or something.
Mm-hmm.
And we must have came upon them, and they just scattered.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you never knew. But I didn't make a big habit of it, but, yeah, we would go off the road every so often.
Okay. All right. Well, when you would go off the road, and in other times when you would come in contact with the local civilian population, what was your impression of them?
Well, just I had a lot of respect for Vietnamese. I mean, they're hard-working people, and you know, just trying to make a living.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they work hard.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't have much of an impression, to tell you the truth. I was I think being wary of everything.
Right.
I was really wary of everything that I noticed over there, and as a policeman, you're taught to really observe, so you're just watching your back all the time.
Okay. All right. Other duties during this time, before getting into things like whenever you volunteered to be a door gunner, were there other duties we haven't covered?
I worked at, we had a little POW cage at LZ Bayonet.
Okay.
And that was really interesting. That was like I had been on the road for a while, and that was really a nice break. And some guys were there permanently from my platoon, and it was really, I think I was working like 6 to 6 in the morning or something, and, you know, we had a Monopoly game, and we'd play Monopoly, and the prisoners, for the most part, except when we'd get some hardcores in there, they'd only stay a day or two before they sent them to Chulai.
Mm-hmm.
And interrogate them there, and it was nice duty. We'd play Monopoly, and most of the prisoners were pretty damn happy that they were out of the war.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it wasn't bad.
Uh-huh. All right. Now, how many prisoners would, would you have at a time?
Just a few.
Okay.
A lot of, sometimes women, sometimes men. And usually we'd get them off at a helicopter, and first thing you do is you just give them a good whack and then turn them over to military intelligence. They just spill their guts because they're scared to death.
Right.
And you want to get the intelligence, and then as, after that, give them a cigarette. Yeah, you know, war's over for you.
Right.
But try to get them to talk as quickly as you could.
What were your impressions of them?
Some tough little characters. I had, you know, especially most of them were NBA.
Okay.
And I remember one kid after, exactly like I did, I gave him a whack off the plane, and he blah, blah, blah. And after that, I would give him a cigarette, and he's just relieved, and he showed me a wound he had, and boy, half his hip must have been, was a scar, you know, because he had been wounded already. And, you know, throw him a couple of cigarettes and some C-rations, and, you know, I just knew they were tough little boogers.
Right.
Real tough.
All right. Could any of them speak any English at all? Or?
No, I don't ever remember any of them speaking English.
Okay. All right. All right. Let's see. Well, how about, tell me how you ended up being a door gunner, how all that came about.
Well, I just, we met some, I guess I'm sort of personal, and I met some pilots somehow, if I remember. And they happened to be part of the headquarters unit for 198th. They had their choppers, naturally, over at Chulai, because you couldn't keep choppers. It was a little too dangerous to keep choppers overnight at Bayonet.
Okay.
And I think all of a sudden one of them said, well, you want to go flying? Okay. And before I know it, they said, you know, a lot of times we can use a door gun or this and that. And, you know, my shifts would change. Sometimes I'd just be on a, you know, night shift. And sometimes you could catch a little couple of winks and nap and this and that. And then I'd go flying with these guys all day. And they gave me my own M60 that I kept in the hooch, and they'd come right to the pad, and they'd say, you available? And I think I would just fly with them. And I got quite a few hours.
Right.
So it was a Loach. It wasn't a Huey, but it was the Loach. And they were headquarters and headquarters company they were attached to, and their nickname was Slow Mo.
Right.
And it was really interesting because I when I went in Air Force Reserve, I got a little envious. All of a sudden, I see these Air Force people walking around with air medals there, and I didn't have nothing. I was a little aggravated.
Mm-hmm.
I go to one gal, so where'd you get that? She goes, well, I think I got it in Panama or something there. Are you kidding me?
Right.
So anyway, I had been looking for these guys, trying to feel for it. And I'm in an elevator at an AmeriCal reunion. I know I'm getting a little away from this, but
sure.
We're in an elevator, my wife and I. And I see this guy, headquarters 198. I go, you know what, blah, blah, I was with the same unit. I was, we were sort of attached. And he goes, and I look at Don, it was one of the pilots I used to fly with.
Really? Wow.
And Don goes, and he remembered me, and we became friends. He passed away a while ago. And but it was one of the, there was only like three or four pilots, and we became friends, and I used to fly door gunner for him.
Huh, wow, right. That you would do this on days off then?
We never had a day off, but
okay.
I would do it when I was working, like, nights.
Okay.
So I would catch a couple hours sleep, and then I would go up all day and fly missions with him. My CO never knew, Ralph Stiles. I told him later I've seen him at reunion. Still not too happy about it.
Right.
And I would fly. I'd be all over the place with these guys.
Okay.
And they basically, you'd sit on the edge of the loach because there's no room to sit, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Sit, you'd have a M60 from a wire hanging from the top, and sometimes we'd have a chicken plate that you would sit on, and then you'd have, you know, your a metal plate that you put over you, and, you know, I'd have the helmet, I'd be talking to the pilot, and I'd help him fuel up, and that, and I'd fly all day with him.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd go back, they'd drop me off at the LZ, and I'd go to work that night.
Right.
Because
oh, wow.
I never had a day off the entire year.
Okay.
Except for R&R.
Right.
And once I was sick a little bit.
Mm-hmm. All right. Would you have the same, pretty much the same schedule every day, or did it, or how was your daily routine? How was that structured?
I'm going to say most of the time I was on patrol. Then I was at the POW cage for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes they would put you on a night shift, okay, because you had to have police presence there on LZ Bain. But you wouldn't patrol at night, naturally. So we would do basically like a bunker guard. You'd have a jeep there, and our bunker at the front gate is the one we would man.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd have an M60 set up there.
Okay.
And two or three you'd man that all night. And we'd always sleep on top of the bunker because, you know, never to sleep inside in case of satchel charge.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think we had desk sergeant all night. But there was not much for call for MPs at night, but you still had to have a presence. So it's when I would do that is then that's when I would do my shenanigans during the day.
Mm-hmm. All right. Any particularly memorable of those missions, any memorable missions as a door gunner?
Basically, a couple of times I remember we were going through some valleys and that, and Don Bowers would be saying, that's the one that passed away, he'd say, there was a 50 caliber here yesterday, so,
right.
51 caliber, so, you know, try to keep your eyes sharp and this and that. And we'd pick up a lot of wounded and stuff because, you know, there wouldn't be a dust off handy, you'd be in the area. So basically they were having us do any mission that came handy. You know, you take observers up and, you know, a lot of dust offs, things like that. And sometimes you take some fire, but I was always lucky. Another friend of mine took my spot one time and he almost got shot down, John Crowley, another MP buddy of mine. And we thought he did get shot down. I was just lucky every time I flew that I didn't see a lot of heavy action. But one of the pilots did get killed out of the three that I flew with Ralph Bigelow in May. So yeah, just luck of the draw.
Right, right. All right.
So I don't remember anything but some small arms and stuff. And,
okay.
You know, letting loose with a couple of, you know, bandoliers of M60 at some bushes and stuff.
Right, right. All right. You mentioned other MPs doing this as well.
My buddy John Crawley was about the only other one. And then late in the career, we also had some friends that worked for, they were MACV, they were interpreters, and they do PSYOP, they were PSYOPs, and we'd go flying on a UE at night.
Right.
And that'd be my buddy John Crawley and myself, and we actually brought up one of our medic buddies one time. And they needed help, and that's I'd be working nights, and they needed help throwing all the pamphlets and stuff on nights, and they had the loudspeakers on the choppers.
Uh-huh.
So we'd fly for that for trills, and they were shooting at you like crazy because they'd be so pissed off, you know, that you were flying around these MBA
right?
with the Chuhoy tape going. Sometimes we'd switch Led Zeppelin in there for the Chuhoy tape.
Uh-huh.
We'd be throwing pamphlets all over. I remember one night I was throwing pamphlets out there, and there was a skill set. You had to open a box of pamphlets, the Chuhoy pamphlets, and then you'd have to sort of half seal it up and turn it upside down and kick it out.
Right.
Well, at first I didn't know, and I just tried to throw them out there.
Yeah.
And the inertia from the helicopter just blanketed the whole helicopter with pamphlets, and the pilots were all aggravated at me and stuff. So, that was a little later. That was, I'm going to say, probably in the fall, just before I went home.
Uh-huh.
So I did several of those missions, too.
Okay.
And again, my CO never knew any of us were missing.
All right.
Yeah. Poor Ralph.
All right.
Yeah, he gets pretty upset. He's, we lost one of our MPs when I was up there and over there, and Ralph still has never gotten over it. So when I see him at a reunion, the stuff about the door gunner, Ned, he gets so teary-eyed and pissed off at me even yet.
right.
It's the way it is.
Right. Well, how many of those PSYOP missions do you think you flew?
Oh, I'm going to say 5 or 6.
Okay. All right. So a lot more fun.
And one night, actually, the helicopter went down. We had either we took a round or we had some mechanical problems.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, and that was over the Batanganang Peninsula by My Lai, around that area there.
Uh-huh. Right.
And I remember the pilot said, we're going down, and it's, you know, it's dark, it's the middle of the night. All these science missions were at night.
Mm-hmm.
And I took off my helmet, I'm taking off my, because he started going over the South China Sea, because I guess he felt it better that we crashed there than on a peninsula there and get taken prisoner, God knows what the pilot, but that's what he did. And he actually maneuvered that UE, and we got just over the gate in Chulai and landed.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Right.
So that was pretty scary.
You said there would there be heavier concentrations of fire at night on those type of missions than on the door gunner missions? Or
yeah, well, yeah, because they were flying right over positions, known positions.
Okay.
See, they knew where they had a good idea where these heavy concentrations of MBA and stuff were, and they were there to harass them at night, and just so they had to fly low enough so they could hear them.
Right.
And then they wanted to throw the pamphlets out.
Uh-huh.
So that's what we would do. So, yeah, you'd see just green little flashes coming. They never hit us, that I could tell. You know, I didn't hear anything, but it'd be so noisy anyway. But, yeah, they were quite aggravated.
Right. I know that the audio would have been in Vietnamese, but it was basically just telling them to surrender and they'll be treated well?
I think so. Yeah, okay. I'm not sure. But and sometimes we put the Led Zeppelin tape on.
Right. How long would those missions last?
That'd be almost all night.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
And we catch little cat naps on the floor and stuff, you know. So I you know, you're a kid, then we catch a little nap, and then I just work all day.
Uh-huh.
Nobody'd know.
Right. Right. How about as far as the door gunner missions, how long would those usually last?
That was almost a full day.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
Yeah, I just get back there in time for my duty.
Okay.
Yeah, and the only reason I know I never had a day off.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that for a fact, so that I know I had to get to work somehow and make up for this.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, when you had a little bit of free time, aside from going on these type of missions, what would you do? Would you write letters home, things like that, or?
Just hang out with the guys, hang out with your friends. That's
uh-huh.
about it. There wasn't much bullshit.
Uh-huh.
There was, you know, you'd work 12-hour days. You know, so and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we had a movie on LZ Bayonet.
Okay.
Actually, it got blown up one night.
Mm. Really?
We had a little movie on, I might have given you pictures of Texas Tech, too, but they tried to say GIs did it, but I can't ever see GIs blowing up their own people there. But there was, several people were hurt, and there was a secondary explosion that blew me off my feet because I was trying to drag somebody out of there. I was actually hanging around with a patrol. I wasn't on duty that night, but I don't know. I was in the MP Jeep going from point A to point B on bayonet. It was just a covered place that had a movie screen and some logs.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that even, yeah, that got blown up one night, too.
Right, right. All right. Well, if we could change gears a little bit here and switch gears, talk a little bit more about the enemy, about the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong. Hey, you talked a little bit about your impressions of them, but what do you remember your first contact with them?
Well, first contact with them probably would be seeing bodies on the side of the road.
Okay.
Because it used to be a habit there if somebody got killed that night or something else, they dragged the Viet Cong body, or MBA, mostly MBA, to the side of the road, and then their guys would pick them up next night, you know, so you'd always see these mangled bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And that was every couple of weeks, you know.
Okay.
So you'd see that, and that's from the night action, the CAP units. Who knows what would happen. And prisoners of war, you know, I had contact with them. Besides that, I wouldn't get much contact, except, you know, they're on the other end of trying to kill you somewhere, send some mortars or something.
Right, right.
You know, mostly bodies.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Any exchanges of fire there on QL1?
Yeah, a couple of times. You know, you'd just shoot in some bushes. You'd hear some rifles and shoot in some bushes. And then another time on LZ Bayonet, we got hit several times.
Mm-hmm.
And there was one time that we were taking some fire from that ridge. Again, they had gone around that ridge or something. And I seen some rifle flashes, and I just couple magazines I popped in there until I didn't see any flashes anymore. And I, you know, there wasn't a real lot of chance to shoot at anything. You know, you get something shot at you, but you didn't know where it came from.
All right. Well, speaking of LZ Bayonet, I know you mentioned a little while ago one night that at least part of it was, one area there was overrun.
April 1st.
April 1st. Could you talk about that night?
Yeah, that was probably the heaviest concentration of firepower in combat that I've seen.
Okay.
Went to bed, it was a normal night, and I'm in my hooch, and all of a sudden, you know, you just knew that we had artillery going out at night, but boy, this, you know, sun's coming in. So I heard some incoming, got up right away, ran out to the bunker, had my flak jacket and my M16 and everything else, and then I think I remember I didn't have my glasses, and I ran back in my hooch, got my glasses on. I still was the first one out there. So
right.
I don't know, I was running around someplace else, and a mortar round went in about 5 feet in front of me, must have been a 60 millimeter, and it went in the sand and blew straight up, and I didn't get touched.
Oh wow.
Yeah,
right.
Just luck of the draw.
Right.
Then all of a sudden, my whole platoon were in the bunkers around us, fighting positions around us. You could see the ridge was burning. You could see the MVA Viet Cong running up and down like they owned the place, because there was flames all over the place. You knew they had overrun it.
Mm-hmm.
Mortars are coming in, and then from behind us, we heard that one of our platoon mates, Rich Delarina, got killed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it just was ugly. And this was all night, and then all of a sudden, we got the choppers came in, the Cobras came in to clear things out.
Okay.
And it just went on for hours.
Right. Right. All right.
I guess they lost several people up on that bunker line too.
Yes, sir. All right. Were there any other incidents like this, or was this the one time that it
no,
got?
No, well, that was the one time that they really overran the bunker line. The other time I told you I was exchanging fire with somebody, that was that was a couple months later, and they didn't overrun the bunker line, but somehow they got in between the bunker line and us.
Okay.
A couple of them, and you know, they were shooting down at us, and that's when you seen some rifle flashes, and we started popping off back at them.
Mm-hmm.
But we got hit mortars and probes with sappers and that maybe 3-4 times during my stay there. Mortars we'd get every so often, but I think they were really scared to come near us with mortars unless they had a whole coordinated attack. LZ Gator, which was south of us, that got overrun so many times and hit so many times they finally had to abandon it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And we'd see the fireworks show there all the time.
Right. All right. Well, any other firefights or engagements of any kind that stand out that you could possibly talk about?
No, just a lot of little incidents. That was probably the April 1st was the one that really sticks in my mind. It was really a fireworks show. That was just like all sorts of stuff was going on.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, it was pretty intense. In fact, we even had a lot of infantrymen that were there that said they'd never seen anything like it.
Mm. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Right.
So, in fact, one guy had just came to the MPs from the infantry, and he wasn't real happy with this whole situation.
Right. Right. All right. Well, other memorable or even funny moments?
Well, there was one funny moment that a couple. One was Mike Gaskins. I remember one time, he, a buddy of mine, they were taking fire from, I believe it, I wasn't with, but they were taking fire from this one area that, right across from Chulai, what was I calling it before the, the rock quarry.
Okay.
And I guess Mike is returning fire to that, and he's yelling at everybody, he's hit, and they get him back, and it was a hot, one of his shell casings went down his shirt. And we teased him about that. And, you know, there was a lot of funny times. Everybody used to lay in everybody all the time. But we were a pretty close bunch at our platoon. Some pretty good guys. And some of them I see since, and a lot of them, they're gone now. You know, they just passed away. But I see my old commander every so often, who poor Ralph didn't know what was going on. Oh, then he tells us. Oh, then there was another time I remember we, I found out they had pizzas at Chulai at the officers club.
Huh, okay.
And, you know, we had one of these field phones at LZ Bay, and you just used to dream about pizzas. It was just incredible. So I called up the officers club and I said, this is Captain Stiles at a Provost Marshal for the 198th. I'm sending a military police jeep up there to get, like, 20 pizzas. You know, they were small pizzas, and right. They're coming up there, so I'm giving them money, and make sure you give them to them. Yes, sir. And so me and my buddies went up there, got all these pizzas. We do that. Then I guess there was another time that Ralph, we invited Ralph to a barbecue,
uh-huh.
And there was just a report about how somebody had broken into the mess hall and stolen all these steaks.
Right. Right.
And then there was a horror house at LZ Dottie. It was incredible that the commander allowed there. It was pretty neat all the time that people were always going there. And there was a place that you could go, you had to run a gauntlet, but you could go to Quang Nai, and there was a MACV compound that you actually could get a hamburger.
Oh, okay.
So being military policemen, we sniffed out all this stuff.
Right.
You know, we knew all about this. And then at the end, too, of my last month, there was a fragging at LZ Dottie. I remember that. And this somebody was doing a PhD on something about Vietnam, and he actually called me because I was the first military policeman there.
Okay.
And they had caught this guy. I found out later through this guy, and they had found who the perpetrator is, but I had ETS by that time, but somebody had just thrown a hand grenade in on his poor captain and killed him.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there was stuff. Like I said, we were in everything.
Right, right. If something like that happened, would you guys then be investigating it? Or?
No, we would call it a CID.
Okay.
But we would be like the, you know, we'd be the police there until they called in the detectives.
Okay, all right.
And that's what they did in this case. But I remember a young second lieutenant was like, he was horrified, and I was just so hardcore by that time. I said, well, maybe he didn't treat his guys right, you know. And this lieutenant's like, couldn't believe I'm saying this, but, you know, what are you going to say? You know, you just, that's how things were back then. It was just getting brutal.
Right. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, from your perspective at this time, as you were getting close to your end of your tour, did you get any perspective at all? Did you even think about things like the larger perspective, like how the war is going?
No.
Okay.
I really, you know, it was like, I really was, I guess, so apolitical. I just, I didn't think much about it.
Mm-hmm.
I really didn't. At that point, I think, especially towards the end of my tour, I just wanted to get home alive. In fact, the night before I left, somebody almost shot me by accident.
Oh, wow.
And then at another time, I was, our duty used to be to, and this was happened during the summer, our duties would be to take, like, if you've seen platoon, or taken out from the latrines and burn all the,
right,
all the poop, you know. So that was my job one night, and by behind a PMO, and you do it, and it was a night patrol, so it's dark, and you pour this diesel fuel on there, which doesn't burn too high. So I poured the diesel fuel in there. It's just about dawn, and I throw a match in there, and this kid that was no doubt a Viet Cong sympathizer had switched the diesel fuel for regular fuel.
Right.
And I almost blew myself up.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah, that was a rude awakening.
Right, right.
So,
oh,
had to be on your toes.
Right. Well, did you get a chance to go on R&R?
Yeah, I went to, I actually finagled myself a leave, too.
Okay.
I got to Bangkok for R&R, and then I got a little few-day leave. I got to Tokyo.
Okay. All right. All right. Just a few more questions about your tour before beginning talking about going home, did you guys ever participate in anything like civic action programs, working with the Vietnamese, helping the Vietnamese, anything like that?
No.
Okay.
No. No, we didn't.
All right.
No, we were just too busy doing our jobs. There were so few of us.
Sure, sure. All right. How many guys would be there on the LZ there?
I'm going to say at LZ Bayonet, because you had basically at least a company each from each battalion.
Okay.
There, I'm going to say we had, there'd be 1,000 people there. We had engineers there, everything else, a good 1,000.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and the rest of the people were out in the field, and they'd rotate these companies in and out.
Right. All right. Okay. Well, anything else from your tour before we talk about coming home?
It's hard to say. I should have probably given it more thought, Jason, but I decided to wing it. I can't really think right now, no. I told you quite a few things, I think.
Sure. All right. Okay. Well, one other question I have for you. Did you, while you were over there, did you hear much about what was going on back in the States with the war protests and things like that?
I remember they had Kent State happen when we were there.
Okay.
And heard about that, and I still could not believe that these National Guardsmen could screw up that bad.
Mm-hmm.
That was my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you give these dumbasses live ammunition if they can't control themselves?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I remember I was still pretty horrified at that. And then My Lai was coming around then, too. You know, they were talking about My Lai, and actually investigations were going on while I was there. And I really, even though I knew guys that were hardcore that thought nothing to throw a hand grenade into a hooch with babies crying and that, but I was horrified to think of shooting civilians and stuff, even back then.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't comprehend that happening.
Right. All right. Well, I know you talked about expressing the, you know, I don't know, horror or whatever about what happened at Kent State, but what did you think about the war protests themselves? Did you give them much thought?
At this stage of my life, I can't really remember what I thought.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I had a... I don't know if I had any feelings about it back then, to tell you the truth. You know, in contents now, naturally I got feelings about it, but what I felt then, I can't really tell you the truth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, if there's nothing else, then I guess we'd move on to the end of your tour and coming home. What was out processing like?
Out processing was pretty interesting. I just got back from Japan, and there was because I went on leave there to Tokyo,
mm-hmm.
but I was late coming back. Because there was a typhoon, our plane just lost altitude like crazy, and we had to go to Cameron Bay. Being a MP, I knew right away to go to a transportation officer and get something saying, I can't get back to Chu Lai.
Mm-hmm.
And I go, yahoo. So I spent several days down there. I got back to in process Chu Lai through the company there, and they said, well, you're like going home like tomorrow or something. So I didn't have a chance to say hello goodbye to anybody. I had to out process in a real hurry and turn my weapons in and stuff like that. And then I got naturally in there, you make it happen. You know, I was just going home. I was just ecstatic, and I went back down to Cameron Bay, and then I think stayed overnight there or something, and got back to Fort Lewis, Washington, and then my hair was too long. They gave me such a hard time. They gave everybody a hard time. I remember, first of all, they took all the people coming back that I think were E5 and below, and they were trying to make us have us make up this barracks and make beds and stuff like that. And so we did that, and everybody's getting a little pissy, and then they go, they take us in our barracks and try to do this again. Just screwing with you, you know. And then the next thing you know, we're putting all the bedding and stuff in the middle. We're going to burn down the barracks. Everybody's just that pissed, okay. E7 comes up, they threw a buffer down the stairs at them. And finally go, wait, guys, you know, you're getting out. You know, they were really, I mean, they were just doing stuff like that. And they made me get a haircut before I got out.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that, too. They weren't going to pay me.
Right.
So it was a fight to the end.
Mm-hmm. All right. How about your reception when you came home? Were there run into any problems in the airport? Anything?
No, I can't ever say I had any protesters, everything. I don't think I would have tolerated it. I never had anybody come up to me or, you know, like you hear a lot of these stories.
Uh-huh.
I don't think I would have. I think I would have just went right at them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nobody was going to spit on me.
Right, right.
And I was pretty well received when I got home, but I didn't realize that. My head was not in a good frame of mind when I got home, for sure.
Did you have much time left in the Army when you returned?
No.
Okay.
Nothing. I think I came back. Went in October 21st. I think it was October 12th I was discharged.
Okay.
So with that time that I had in Bayonne, I had almost my full 2 years.
Okay. All right. So there, but you had a little bit of a difficulty adjusting at first when you got back?
Oh, yeah. I would say it was years.
Okay.
Yeah, I thought I was all right, but even I was married like 2 years later, almost 3 years, and I still was, all the blinds were drawn down, and I had all the windows closed. My poor wife was just like, you know, that's just how it was. So I wasn't, I thought back then it was, everything was normal, but, you know, hindsight that I was not even kilter at all.
Well, once you got back, did you follow the war closely on TV? Did you pay attention to it?
Oh yeah. I think so. I, you know, the Easter Offensive, and then when the whole thing fell, I think I felt pretty bad. You know, and then of course you had Watergate going on and everything else through those years. And,
right.
Yeah, it was hard not to pay attention. But then I wouldn't tell people that I was a veteran at, because you couldn't get hired for a job if you told me you were a Vietnam vet.
Mm-hmm.
So I know I couldn't do that. I had to make my old place hire me back because they didn't want to hire me back. And then when I applied for other jobs, I didn't put nothing down about service or anything.
Mm-hmm. All right. One more question about the way the war came to a conclusion, the way it ended. Were you surprised by that? Surprised by the way things ended?
No. Probably not, because I think you could sort of see it coming, because it's just, you know, they just were half-stepping, you know. I mean, you could see that, you know, they just stopped bombing them, and they could have just came in with, they just didn't want no more to do with it. You could see it. I was disappointed, all these lives lost and stuff, to be sure. But, you know, there was nothing you can do on it at this pay grade.
Right. All right. Well, after you got back, you talked about jobs. And what kind of work did you do after you got back?
Printing. I've always been a printer, and I went back to my other job, and then I started going to school on a GI Bill, and I got a degree in printing.
Okay.
And I made a career out of it. I'm semi-retired, and I work out of a house now. And I actually do the I design the journal for the AmeriCal Division Association.
Okay. All right. And I know you mentioned earlier that you got back into the military.
Right. I didn't pay no attention when they called me for reserve duty and stuff, and I just threw it away.
Uh-huh.
And then after being out almost 18 years, I went back in the Army Reserve, the military police unit here.
Okay.
And then I was there for, I came back in as a PFC, believe it or not.
Oh, wow.
And I stayed with them about a year and a half, and then I transferred into the Air Force Reserve.
Okay.
And I retired in 07 as a master sergeant.
Okay.
And I went to Desert Storm. I was in Turkey, and then I was in the Middle East for the Global War on Terror. So I volunteered for all that stuff, too.
Okay. Would you mind talking a little bit about some of those assignments?
Not at all.
Okay.
Not at all.
All right. So you said you went to the Desert Storm and to the more recent.
Well, Desert Storm, I was a E5 in Air Force. I was in transportation where you load planes and that.
Okay.
And they had a tour going over to a short tour over to Incirlik, Turkey.
Okay.
Which I got on that tour. So they gave us campaign participation because it's an area of responsibility, and I loaded planes there, and it wasn't bad at all. I got into the Turkish culture, and it was only 3-4 weeks, but loaded some planes, and things were winding down, and they really didn't have much of a need for us, and we came home.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I got the campaign credit for it, and then I went into multimedia field in the Air Force.
Okay.
After that, because they closed my base down, and I transferred up to another unit in Milwaukee, 440th, and I became the going through ranks. I became the multimedia manager, and I was still classified as a graphic artist. But the graphic artist during wartime duty is to work with Air Force intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
So I finagled myself a tour of duty over there in 06.
Okay.
And I worked with the 335th Fighter Squadron, F-15 Squadron.
All
right. And it was just incredible. I was one of a very few Vietnam vets that have served over there, and they treated me so well. And I did work with intelligence with the video, gun cameras and things like that.
Right.
And it was just really incredible. So I was so mission-oriented because I knew this to be my last hurrah, and I took just thousands of pictures and video, and tried to make sure that I, you know, annotated everything.
All right.
And then a year after that, I needed a new hip and stuff, so I finally retired.
Mm-hmm. All right. What initially made you decide to go back in?
I don't know. I just said, well, they had a one-year sign-up for the Army Reserve. I guess they were having a hard time getting people, and this is like 1988.
Uh-huh.
And a friend of mine says, you should try it, this and that. And I, you know, I got myself in pretty good shape again. And I said, well, you know, it's a year. I said, well, and I talked to my wife. Yeah, go ahead, this and that. And I got into it, and I found it very, it's sort of fascinating. I was a little, you know, I was a little humbled to be a PFC, this and that, and, you know, you got a combat patch, and people are going,
right,
you know, oh, my gosh, what are you doing here? But I was beating up the kids in the PT and stuff.
Right.
And I said, well, this is fun. And then I didn't like how the Army Reserve was treated by the active duty,
okay,
like bastard stepchildren. I mean, it was just, you know, they're treating you like you're non-existent.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, I said, well, I'm going to see about another service. And I don't know how I got hooked up with the Air Force. They said, you don't have to, because of job situations, I didn't have to retrain and go to schools again. They said, we've got an OJT program here for air transportation you can get in.
Mm-hmm.
And you've had basic training. You don't have to do that. And we'll take you on. And it's, I think I have signed up for 2 years or 3 years. I don't know. I said, okay, you know, why not? And I came in there, and I never looked back, and I just had a great career. And when I'd go on active duty with the Air Force, it was just, it's seamless.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they treat you, you're an NCO in the Air Force, period, no matter where you go. And they just, it was just a wonderful career.
Mm-hmm. All right. How much, could you get an idea about how much the military had changed since Vietnam?
Big time.
Okay.
Yeah, when I went in this military police company with the Army Reserve, I told you I wasn't. That's when they kept testing me, and that's when I found out that I was 5'8" and a half.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife said, "You're not 5'10" like you thought you were." And then I got this little lieutenant, and this because there were no females in the military police when I was in the first time, and she's about 5'4", and she comes to drill one day crying because she hit a squirrel or something on the way to drill. And that sort of dawned on me. I just said, "Oh my gosh, things have changed." And then it got more and more politically correct at the end of the my tour there. It was like, "Oh my goodness, please quit sissifying me." You know, I'd be yelling at my Air Force guys. I'd say, "Get down and give me one, will you?" And it's like, yeah, there were some things that was hard to get used to.
Right.
You know, it's definitely a different military now. In some ways, they're much more refined and better, but Drill Sergeant Johnson, it's a shame that people like him can't exist anymore, because that, to me, was the essence of the military.
All right. Well, one last question on this time period in your career. Did you ever get a chance to impart any of the things you learned in Vietnam to the younger guys?
I always did, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I think I always did. In fact, my old troops are still very close to me. I've got them all over the place, and they call me all the time and that, and I use it really as a mentoring tool. And then one quick story. When I was in the desert, you might enjoy this. It's about 2 o'clock in the morning. You had to take buses where you go, and I'm in my uniform, and my desert uniform, and there's a guy sitting at the bus stop that's about my age, and he's looking a little old, and we start toying with each other, and I say, "Well, I go back a long ways," and he goes, "I go back further." And I go, "You got to be kidding me." And I go, I go 1968. He goes, 1967. He goes, "I've never left the Army. I'm in the Army, and I've never left." He was a warrant officer 5. So I carry my combat patch for the Americal and my your ID case that I had there. I show him. I said, "I was in the Army. Do you ever know these guys?" He goes, "The Americal division. I was in the same unit."
Wow.
Yeah. Huh. How's that for a chance meeting? So we became friends.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. How about that? Right. All right. Well, before wrapping up the interview, if you don't mind, I'd like to ask you some broad questions about Vietnam. Get your opinion on some of the larger issues of the
war.
Okay. Looking back on your experience in Vietnam at this point in your life, how do you feel about your service in Vietnam and about American involvement in Vietnam?
I think we belonged over there. I think that we and half step like we tend to do sometimes. I wouldn't change it for the world. I'm glad I came back safe. It's made me who I am. There's no doubt about it. It's made me who I am. I'm very grateful that I had the opportunity to serve this country in all my years of service, and I feel really it was a privilege.
All right. What did you, could you comment a little bit about on how the war was handled? I know you talked about half steps, but could you talk a little bit more in detail about that from your perspective?
Well, yeah, I feel I'm a warrior at heart, and I feel that if you're going to fight a war, why didn't we go up north and just kick their ass?
Right.
You know, that's what it mildly, you know. Cut the head off. They never cut the head off.
Right. Right.
You know, and what, were we afraid of the Chinese? I don't know. But, you know, if you're going to do it, why half step?
Right. All right. From someone who saw the today's Army, from your perspective, do you think some of the lessons of Vietnam were learned?
Yes. Well, with the military police corps, that's a gimme, because they're all trained for combat now, and OJT on police work second. I think they've learned quite a bit, and the Air Force as well, where they go in, when they do go in with lethal force, they go in all the way with lethal force. I still think sometimes we're pretty kindly people that we were always so worried about collateral damage and stuff. But if we didn't start it, you know, that's not a problem, you know.
Mm-hmm. All right. What did you think about, looking back on it now from your perspective now, about the media's coverage of the Vietnam War?
Oh, I think it was slanted, just like it's slanted right now.
Mm-hmm.
I think you don't hear any of the good stories. You just hear the negativity. I think the media really did put a kibosh to the whole Vietnam conflict, and I think it worked well with the invasion of Iraq, but only because the DOD realized that they had to implant civilian media personnel with the military to get them on our side.
Mm-hmm.
And then when that was over, you can see how most of the media has gone away and only projects negativity.
Mm-hmm. So you think the idea of actually implanting the reporters there with the guys actually helped at that
Absolutely.
Time?
Absolutely, and I know that from a fact because I was with Air Force Multimedia.
Okay,
and this has
right.
come up in our conferences.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a gimme.
What would how would that change them? How would that make them? Could you explain a little bit more?
Because what happens is you actually, if the media is implanted with the military, actually
mm-hmm.
are with these units and that, and interact with them, they have a hard time giving a slanted news story.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they actually report more because they feel that they're part of this
right.
rather than outside of this. Is that making myself clear?
Sure. So they come to, I guess in many ways, empathize with the guys there, and they can see things from their perspective?
Yes.
Okay.
I think they can be objectionable, but they can actually see things from a different perspective.
Uh-huh. Right. Okay. All right. How about, from your perspective today again, could you comment on the protest movement?
Oh, my gosh. I think it's absolutely ridiculous. If they, after being over there and seeing the intelligence and seeing the things that I see about these bad guys and how they want a piece of us,
mm-hmm.
anybody that's protesting anything against the war has got rocks in their head.
Because mm-hmm.
these people are out to kill them and their children.
Right.
You know, and if they want to just kiss flowers and things like that, that's fine. But I'm telling you, this is the real boogeyman.
Mm-hmm.
More so than even the Viet Cong
right.
ever were or the North Vietnamese. These people want a piece of you.
Mm-hmm. How about taking it back to Vietnam, though? Do you think it was misguided then as well?
Well, I think that it was. I think it could have been handled a lot better.
Okay.
I think that the communist boogeyman was there, but it could have been controlled more with diplomacy
mm-hmm.
rather than. Sending just millions of troops, at least having a fierce factor done in a different way.
Okay.
And then once you did commit, you'd need to commit wholeheartedly, not just piecemeal like they did.
Mm-hmm. All right.
And it went on too long, and the Americans lose heart. Even during World War II, the Americans lost heart during that. And they were saying, people back home, you know, they report it now. If you're a historian, you would understand that people were not happy with that war towards the end.
Right.
And you just can't keep these things going for years and years without having a degradation of opinion at home.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. All right. What's your opinion of, I guess, modern-day Vietnam and U.S. policy towards modern-day Vietnam with trade and tourism, things like that?
It changes. My opinion changes. I was dead set against it before.
Okay.
I know a lot of people have gone over there. But I still feel that they're a thug government,
mm-hmm.
you know, and very oppressive. They're better now, only because the Vietnamese like to deal with things. But I think they're still a very oppressive government. I think we lose sight of that sometimes, and the almighty buck just makes up for everything, especially
mm-hmm.
from... You know, our ideas, deals can really shift when it comes to that dollar.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, along the lines of veterans returning to Vietnam, have you ever given any thought to that?
I've been asked several times, and one of my platoon mates that passed away, I probably would have gone with him. Mm-hmm. I've got another platoon mate. If he decided he was going to go, I would probably go with him, but I don't think I'd be comfortable. I've had a lot of other veteran friends that want to go, but I think it'd have to be one of my platoon mates. And I love to travel. I'll travel anywhere. Mm-hmm. I've been all over the world.
Right.
But I would, I don't know. You know, it'd take, if my buddy Eck was still alive, one of my platoon mates, I would go. He wanted to go, I would go in a heartbeat with him.
All right. All right, just a few last questions here.
Sure.
Have you been to the Vietnam Wall?
Oh, several times, yes.
Okay. What's your impression of it?
Well, I think it's a wonderful, beautiful monument. I mean, important to all of us Vietnam vets. I'm not a guy that gets choked up or anything. I'm just one of these people that sort of put his feelings behind him, so I don't get choked up. But I think it's a wonderful memorial.
Mm-hmm. All right. All right. Well, last couple of questions here. Let's see. What would you say was the biggest impact? I know it's a broad question, but the biggest impact that Vietnam had on you, that your service in Vietnam had on your life?
I think that all through my life I could always say, well, it could always be a lot worse.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, I mean, even when I was in Vietnam, I'd look at the poor grunts and I'd say, boy, I don't have it that bad. So it's given me that kind of feeling.
All right. Well, anything else you'd like to say? Anything else we should cover before wrapping the interview up?
No, Jason, I think we covered just about everything.
All right.
Sure did.
All right. Well, I'll go ahead and bring the interview to a close then.